Join us this week as we descend into the darker side of human nature and uncover the shadows that dwell in the unknown. From chilling true crime and gruesome murders to spine-tingling paranormal encounters that defy explanation, we're peeling back the curtain on things that go bump in the night. So grab a flashlight and maybe a blanket, because you're listening to The Guilty and the Ghostly.
Officially on episode 9. Tori looks a little different today. Say hi, Tori.
Hi, Tori.
So Tori couldn't make it. She is in the process of moving to her new apartment. She's working. We had softball literally every day this week. Our daughter had softball literally every day this week. So we just couldn't link up the same schedule. And because Tori's the person she is. Shoot, we just couldn't make it work. But we're here. We didn't want to leave you guys hanging. So we're going to go ahead and have a special guest. So this is Josh.
Hey, everybody.
You might have already heard his voice in the introduction. He recorded that for me last night. Only took some arm bending and twisting and pulling. But he did it. I like it. I think it turned out well. You have a voice for radio. Or maybe it's a face for radio.
It's definitely a face for radio.
So a couple of updates that I wanted to go over. I know last week's audio was a little rough. Again, we're learning. Tori's voice is so quiet, it's hard to pick up in the microphone, and mine is so loud. So I'm trying to figure out how to get that adjusted. It's very difficult. We also have a few shout outs for Nellie Guzman, Mickey Parker, Jennifer Atkin, aka Mimi. Hi, Mimi. Say hi to Mimi.
Hi, Mimi.
You're so weird. Aaron Jones, Aiden Harris, Jordan Newman, Tyler Walker. You guys have been commenting, sharing, liking, all that fun stuff. But we also have an MVP shout out. So her name is Tessa Corley Roycroft. She's been liking, sharing, and commenting everything. And she actually sent me today's case. So big shout out to her. Another big accomplishment. We finally hit 1,000 downloads. I didn't think we would this soon, but we're actually a little over 1,000 downloads. Last time I looked, I think we're at like 1,060 or something like that. So thank you guys. Just a reminder, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, YouTube. Where do you listen to us at?
Spotify.
Spotify. That's where a lot of them are, Spotify. We also have TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, anywhere, everywhere. I even made a link tree so you guys could find us a little bit easier, a little bit faster. Give us the 5-star ratings. That helps get our name out there. It helps the streaming platforms push it out. So all those 5-star reviews really help, and we couldn't do it without you guys. So now that we bribed them and begged them, I guess we're going to move on to today's case. It's local. It's another local one. We have a lot of stuff that happens around here. Have you noticed? So this week, I'm taking you on a chilling dive into the tragic and twisted story of a woman whose life was shaped by trauma, hardship, and ultimately murder. This is the story of Betty Lou Beats, the Black Widow of Henderson County. Have you heard anything about this one?
Never heard of this.
You listen to true crime not as much as I do, but you do.
Occasionally. Usually only when we're watching it together.
Well, you listen to Mr. Baldwin.
Mr. Baldwin.
Baldwin, yeah. And the last podcast on the left, we listen to them.
Yeah, but they're not really too much true crime on that one.
Yeah, I guess. We kind of cover a little bit of everything.
Yeah. And I kind of pick and choose what I listen to also.
Yep. Well, we're going to talk about Betty Lou Beats today. She was born Betty Lou Dunavant on March 12, 1937 in Wilkesboro, North. We're going to talk about... It's like recording a story, I swear. I'm gonna have to get like a spray bottle for that every time we record or doing something.
I'm so sorry. It didn't even cross my mind.
We're going to be talking about Betty Lou Beats today. She was born Betty Lou DeNevott on March 12th in 1937 in Roxborough, North Carolina. She was the second child to her parents. She had an older brother named Dewey and two younger siblings. Her father's name was James Garland DeNevott, and her mother was Margaret Louise Smithwick DeNevott. A hell of a last name.
Yeah.
At this time, everyone's trying to recover from the Great Depression. The home that they lived in was more like a cabin or a shack almost. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have running water. They didn't even have like glass covering their windows to keep the elements out.
I couldn't imagine like that.
No, thank you. Not only were their living conditions rough, but Betty Lou had a rough childhood all around. She had contracted the measles at a really young age and ended up losing. I never really did find out if she completely lost her hearing or if she lost most of it and then was able to gain some of it back as she got older, but she was considered deaf for at least a while. But I think she did recover a little bit of it back as she got older. She also said she was sexually abused at the hands of her own father. Her mother would claim mansions in their local town to make money for the family. She would come home and tell the kids about these magnificent houses that they got to clean and telling them like every little detail about the house. The kids and Margaret always enjoyed the nightly recaps of her day. It almost provided like an escape for them. So they're in this really down, dark, bad place, and that was just kind of like their little escape that they got to get away for a little while. It was a stark contrast to the way the family lived. Since they did live in poverty, the family couldn't even afford milk and vegetables for their kids. They were forced to survive off of flour, cornmeal, and salted pork. But she know what salted pork is?
Not really.
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's pork that they heavily salt to make sure that it doesn't spoil. And
okay, yeah.
Normally it's not used for main course meals. Normally it's more like an additive, I guess, almost like a pork bits or whatever. For like in beans and stuff. Instead of using the actual pork, it's almost like a heavily processed meat. The only source of heat for the home was a coal stove, but remember they have no actual windows, so a lot of the heat would just be lost and it didn't really, unless you're right on the stove, they couldn't feel it. Due to this, the kids were always battling colds and the flu during winters. There in 1940s, medicines weren't readily available. So the best cure is to, you know, keep them warm, rest, plenty of food, but they have no windows, so how are they supposed to stay warm? And they can barely provide the basic needs for food, so it was a constant fight, almost like a losing battle for the family. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the family moved from North Carolina to Virginia, and Margaret and James were able to find work at cotton mills. They were finally able to provide more than just the basic necessities for their family. They moved into an actual house that had windows to keep the family warm. But unfortunately, after the move is when Betty Lou actually contracted the measles at the age of 3. It nearly killed her. She had a temperature of 105 for days. For literal days, her temperature was over 105 degrees.
Wow.
And there wasn't much that they could do. Her mother would just try to keep the temperature at bay. Basically, all she could do was keep her like in cold baths, cold compresses, and just try to keep her internal temperature down. She prayed daily to God, asking him to heal her child and to not take her baby from her because Margaret was in such bad shape. Which I cannot imagine having to do that, seeing your child suffering like that and having those issues, and there's literally nothing you can do. Just with the measles, Betty Lou was constantly fighting ear infections. She finally seemed to be on the mend and went back to school, but she struggled due to not being able to hear the teachers. She ended up having to repeat the 4th grade. She was devastated that her friends would be going on to the 5th grade and she would be staying behind. It wasn't long the other kids began making fun of her for it. They would call her names like stupid and just be downright cruel. They would also make fun of her for being poor, and her self-esteem plummeted. She began believing all the hurtful things the other children were saying. During this time is actually when her mother gave birth to her other 2 siblings, First came Jimmy, and then 2 years later, a daughter named Jackie. Only 4 years later, Margaret had a mental breakdown. There were never any signs or symptoms that had shown before this. It just seemingly came out of nowhere. So the mother seemed fine. She seemed good, completely stable, and it was just almost like a light switch went off. She started, and it even happened just one day at work. She was at the cotton mill. They had to call an ambulance, rush her to the hospital. She was admitted to the hospital and was there for about a week before they were finally able to release her. Again, no signs before. She had no clue how to process the sudden change, and she was completely terrified on what would come next. Would another episode come about? They didn't really have a whole lot that they could do at that time. Doctors had prescribed medicines to try to help regulate her. They would also stop by daily just to check in on her. But not long after that, she started having hallucinations of demons and hearing voices. She would even try to fight off the hallucinations that she was having, and many people would witness this. So again, she's just gone off the deep end. They had no clue what was coming, no signs before, and there's only so much that they can do. So Betty Lou would witness her mom fighting off these demons and like physically trying to attack other people or even things that weren't even there. And it really affected Betty Lou. She even started to wonder, would the same thing happen to her as she got older, which really freaked her out. During all this, Betty Lou, at the age of 12, began basically having to raise herself along with her brother, Dewey. They all really depended on each other. Margaret was eventually sent to the Eastern State Hospital, which was about 200 miles away. She was there for about 3 months. While there, she went through some grueling treatments like shock therapy and insulin coma therapy, which I had never heard of that one before. Have you?
No, what is that?
They would basically inject a large amount of insulin to induce the coma in the patient. At this time, it was a crucial treatment in psychiatry in the United States, and was phased out after the invention of antidepressants. It was later discovered that the insulin coma therapy really had no benefits to the patients. It would just basically knock them out and make it easier for them to be dealt with as patients. Betty Lou then began being made fun of for her mother. The other students would go far as pretending to have seizures and throwing their hands around just to mess with Betty Lou, which I would want to punch a kid in the face. Are you kidding me? Kids are...
They're jerks.
They're jerks. So the constant bullying really got to Betty Lou, and she got to where she absolutely hated school. She began stepping up as the mother role in her home and taking care of her younger siblings. She cooked, she cleaned, she watched the siblings, and often would like be leaving her too tired to even go to school. So she ended up just basically not going. The stress took a lot of toll on her physical body as well. And mind you, she's like preteen at this age, and she only weighed about 80 pounds. Her father would come home drunk. Betty Lou became scared of her father. Any little thing would set him off, and he'd beat her with his leather belt. After the beating, she would just be sure to watch her every move to avoid setting him off. But then this created a lot of hostility towards her father, and it was just that constant dynamic with those two, where she would just avoid him at all costs, but then she would come across him, he would get set off and just beat the crap out of her. So once Betty Lou turned 15, she ended up marrying Robert Franklin Branson, who was 18 years old. At first, he seemed like a really quiet and hardworking man. He worked at a local zipper factory, which is a very 1940s job to me, a zipper factory.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Margaret would actually force Betty Lou to marry Robert. Margaret believed that Betty Lou was pregnant since she had not gotten her period yet. The only obvious reason, obviously, that she was pregnant, it's not that she was malnourished. It wasn't the stress of taking on multiple children as a teenager. So the only obvious thing was she's pregnant. She hasn't had her period. She's pregnant. Again, not all the outside factors. So she, Betty Lou ended up seeing it kind of as her way out to get out of the house. So she was like, you know what? Let's do it. And she got married on July 18th in 1952, a month after Betty Lou finished her freshman year of high school.
Wow.
Only a year later, Betty Lou was pregnant with their first child, Faye. Betty Lou just wanted to be a normal teenage girl. She once stated that, I am no better off now than I was cooking and cleaning for my parents, having it was her way out, and then she's pregnant, and now she's still doing the same thing. She's still taking care of the kids. Robert thought that maybe if he made more money, it would make Betty Lou happier. He found a better paying job and started to try to spoil Betty Lou and their daughter, Faye. Betty Lou began to resent her life, feeling like she was stuck at home with the child and not being able to come and go as she pleased. She would often run into old classmates who, again, would just rub it in her face that they were having the best time at school with prom, homecoming, all the fun things they got to do. And it made her just miss being a kid, I think. But she never really got a chance to be a kid. Even as a kid, she had to take care of her siblings and do all that stuff, so... The couple was constantly arguing and separated for about 6 months. So that meant that Betty Lou and her daughter had to move back in with her parents. I'm sure that was devastating for her.
Mm-hmm.
She eventually became extremely depressed and ended up trying to take her own life by swallowing 2 bottles of Tylenol. Her parents found her unconscious with 2 empty bottles next to her. They called her husband Robert and told him what happened. Robert rushed to the hospital to be with her, and he later convinced her to get back with them, so they ended up reconciling. Now, not very long after they rekindled their relationship, Betty Lou was pregnant with her second daughter, Connie. Things really seemed to be going well for them. Robert got a new job in Texas, so they moved down to Texas now, and he was working construction. With the new job came more money, and Betty Lou actually began enjoying being at home with her 2 young children. So she finally made a turn and enjoyed the home life and taking care of the kid and the wife and doing all that stuff. Quickly, the family began to grow with a total of 6 kids.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't imagine having that many.
We have 3.
3 is enough.
And they drive us nuts. We love our kids. We love our kids. But 3 kids is a lot. I can't imagine 6.
No, me either.
No, thank you. Which I've got several siblings.
Mm-hmm.
You've only got 2.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way.
I just couldn't imagine having that many kids in the house.
No. So, Phyllis was born in 1962. Robert Jr., also known as Robbie, was born in 1964. And then Bobby was born in 1966. So, it was really wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Every 2 years, she was another kid. No, thank you. I feel like we have a good space between our kids. Because our first 2 are exactly 3 years and 1 day. And then between our middle one and our last one, it's... 3 years, 6 months, and a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's a good spacing. Having that many just 2 years apart. Imagine the diapers they had to buy.
And we thought they were expensive when we were young.
I know. So when Betty was only 29 years old, she was considered very attractive. She was always wearing heels. She had her makeup and hair done no matter what. She had began feeling the weight of being home with the 6 kids, and Robert was always working late and not coming home until after midnight, which we'll get into that in a little bit. I don't think he was just working. She started to crave attention from others, and so she ended up going out. She would get all dressed up and then have her older kids watch the younger ones while she went out in Dallas. Men began fighting over her, and she was getting the attention she was wanting, but her kids then started resenting her for always leaving, and then the house started going kind of to the wayside and not being kept up as much, and then Robert started noticing that she was always gone. So in 1969, they ended up divorcing, and this is kind of why I think maybe he wasn't just working, coming home after midnight. Very quickly, Robert remarried to a younger woman, so there were rumors that he was stepping out. He wasn't just working, he was out and about, stepping out. Betty Lou went through a really hard time after the divorce, not just emotionally, but financially as well. She ended up getting full custody of the kids, which required Robert to pay child support of $350 a month, which at that time was...
For six kids?
For six kids. But, so in today's money, that would be about $3,000. Equivalent to about $3,000.
Really?
For six kids. You'd be broke. You're already broke, but you'd be really broke.
You guys keep me broke.
Listen, we listen and we don't judge. It was still not enough to cover the bills, though. It helped, but it just wasn't enough. She started drinking and bar hopping every night just to escape what was going on. The kids began leaving as soon as they could, or Betty Lou would even just send them away. Faye would actually marry a man at the age of 15. So just a full circle moment. I think she was looking to get out and married at 15. But from everything that I read, he was a really good man. And he actually took care of her. And it worked out for her. After Faye moved out, Betty Lou would eventually send Robbie, who's 8, and Phyllis, who's 10, to live with Robert and his new wife. So she's like, honeymoon's over. Take my kids. I'm out. This hurts my heart. Robbie was crying. He didn't want to leave his mother's house and begging to stay with her. She just told him, soon. I'll see you soon. And it was another 5 years before she seen him again. I could not do that. When she finally seen him, it was only for about 5 minutes. Another 5 years go by, and then Robbie moves back in with his mother. So they're just sending this kid to move in with the mother that he hasn't seen in 10 years, but, you know, one time for a few minutes. Connie eventually moved in with her sister, Faye, and Shirley house hopped between her friends most of the time. Bobby was considered her favorite, and she wanted him to live with her. So she was like, come, you're coming back with me. You're staying. The kids noticed that after the divorce, Betty Lou never really truly found happiness again. Connie once told a friend that most of the good times with her mother were before the divorce. She recalled that Betty Lou would do everything she could to keep Robert happy. Robert would work long hours and not come home till really late, but Betty Lou would do her hair and makeup before bed so that she would look her best for when he did finally come home. Which, again, you can feel bad for her. Your husband's supposedly working long hours, getting home late. You're doing everything to keep him happy, keep it kosher, and it still wasn't enough. At 33 years old, Betty Lou would marry again in 1970. So this is husband number 2. We have a few husbands. A few.
A few?
A few. So, marriage number 2, 33 years old. She marries again in 1970. The man's name was Billy York Lane. Betty Lou was excited to introduce Billy to her kids, telling them they would love him, even though she barely even knew him. A couple months tops. Unfortunately, this marriage was full of abuse. Billy had a huge temper, and they were both very toxic to each other. The fights would ensue, being fueled by jealousy from both parties. Betty Lou began gaining weight soon after they were married, and she began taking a diet pill called Dexatrin to help her lose weight. Had you heard of that? I hadn't either.
No, but I can definitely identify with the gaining weight.
She would actually take more than what was recommended, and she said the weight would just fall off with the more she took. Which, of course, it did. It was basically just over-the-counter amphetamine. Not only was she taking that, but she was also still drinking heavily while she was taking it. So I can only imagine. She began suffering from side effects like insomnia, mood swings, anger. She was always lashing out. Her children really noticed the difference in her personality. She seemed to have almost like a Jekyll and Hyde. She would be really calm and loving one second, and then a little thing would happen and she would just fly off the handle and be irate. Billy would often beat her and would leave her just completely covered in bruises. And he knew that her not being able to keep up with her appearance would affect her more than anything, and eventually she couldn't even cover the bruising up with makeup. She finally filed for a restraining order in October of 1970, and they were divorced just 2 months later. They continued to fight after the divorce. Betty Lou would come home after work, and Billy would be sitting in the car in her parking lot just watching her. She would see him following her when she would leave. Eventually, Betty Lou went to a doctor, desperate for help. She confided in him that she just couldn't stay away from Billy, even though he was abusive. So instead of the doctor doing his job, all he did was take notes of her injuries and prescribed her an antidepressant and just sent her on the way. Didn't tell the police, didn't tell her to go to the police, just, you crazy woman, here's some antidepressants, you're fine.
Wow.
Just a few months later, Betty Lou had to go to the emergency room because Billy had hit her so hard he split her eye open and she needed stitches. In May of 1971, Billy and Betty Lou got into another fight and he broke her nose. Betty Lou then grabbed a gun and shot Billy twice in the back. Not saying you should shoot somebody, but if they're beating the hell out of you.
That's a good reason.
Yeah. So Billy was rushed into emergency surgery. They had to remove the two bullets. The police were called and they arrested Betty Lou and had charged her with attempted murder and with malice. Billy claimed that he was completely blindsided when she grabbed the gun and he didn't see it coming. Betty Lou told police that she was in fear for her life, but due to him being shot in the back, the police had a hard time believing her side of the story. Again, crazy woman. She's, you know, just being hysterical. Her daughter had actually told the police that she was there for the entire incident. She told them that Billy had called the house and Connie actually answered the phone. And he told her that he's on his way, and Connie knew how bad it would get when he would come around. So she hung up and then dialed the operator and asked them to call the police. But Billy's daughter claimed that she was actually at his house and was listening on the other line when they got a phone call. And it was actually Betty Lou who called Billy. She was crying and told Billy he needed to come over and get his stuff. Billy supposedly asked, well, how many times are you going to shoot me? And Betty Lou allegedly said, none. Billy's daughter said that Billy was trying to meet Betty Lou somewhere to collect his things, but she said, no, you have to come to the house. So Billy decided to go. He told his daughter he'd be back in about half an hour, and she begged him not to go. He went anyways. But it was later on during the investigation, Billy confessed to the police officers that he had actually threatened to kill him before she shot him. So he did threaten her life. With that, all charges were dropped. The two ended up rekindling their relationship right after.
What?
They remarried and were divorced about a month for the second time. Which they said, I'd have to look at the study, but they say it takes somebody about 7 times to leave an abusive relationship. Really? On average. Mm-hmm. And it is the most dangerous time for someone that's being abused. The most dangerous time for them is when they are actually trying to leave. That's normally when they are murdered.
I can see that.
So the next year, Betty Lou began dating another man named Ronnie Throckhold. Ronnie was also known to be a heavy drinker. 4 years later, the couple were married in 1978. So this is husband number 3, if you're counting. It's number 3. They argued a lot, and Betty Lou eventually tried running him over with her car. They divorced soon after that.
I imagine so.
Listen, we've been together, I guess, about 19 years.
Same like that.
This year will be 16 years that we've been married. I don't think I've ever tried to run you over in the car.
How about you ran into a house?
We haven't talked about that. I didn't run into the house. I clipped the corner of a house. I did not run into the house.
You're still in the house.
I clipped it. So Betty Lou then started working at a topless bar. She was eventually arrested for public indecency and had to spend 30 days in jail. In 1979, she fell in love again and married her fourth husband. His name is Doyle Wayne Baker. All I can think is, Doyle Wayne. Mm-hmm. During an argument in October of 1981, Betty Lou told family and friends that he took off on foot, leaving behind his car. He was never seen again. Betty Lou would then marry her fifth husband, a retired fireman named Jimmy Don Beats. Husband number five. Husband number four, they were together, got in an argument. He took off on foot, never seen again. Left his car behind, though. Left his car behind. A little weird. So put a pin in that. About 2 years later, on August 6, 1985, Betty Lou called the police and reported husband number five missing. According to Betty Lou, Jimmy went out on his boat on Cedar Creek Lake and never returned. That's where we went for Josh Riverland.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the girls swear the snakes were trying to attack him, which there were snakes.
Whenever there being snakes.
I didn't see him, but another adult that was right there with them said there were snakes, but they were just kind of like hanging out. But when the girls tell the story, the snakes were chasing them and after them. So they were only...
Oh, they were little.
Six and three, maybe?
Maybe.
Maybe. So
I think we had Jackson with us. But he was in that pen, that little place.
Yeah, so yeah, they were probably maybe seven. Yeah. Seven and four, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, according to Betty Lou, Jimmy went out on his boat on Cedar Creek Lake, never returned. 6 days later, his boat was found empty, floating on the lake at the Redwood Beach Marina, which was about 14 miles from their home. Two people actually went out and pulled his empty boat to shore, where they found his life vest, a fishing license, and his heart medication. They also found his ID and were able to link the boat to Jimmy. So the owner of the marina called the marina looked up the number in the phone book and called the home several times. Betty Lou never answered. They finally were able to get a hold of her, and she went down to the marina and confirmed it was, in fact, her husband's boat. So the Coast Guard and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, they started to investigate. The following day, they began searching for Jimmy in the lake. They had hoped that he would just return home later that night, but they never did. When deputies arrived at the Beats home, Betty told them that Jimmy had been having issues with his boat, and they ended up finally forming a search party to search all over the lake to see if they can find him. 3 weeks go by. Still haven't found him. Still haven't found this guy. So the fire chief, because he was a retired fireman, the fire chief went to visit with Betty Lou, just checking on her, see how she's doing. She had asked if she would receive any of the benefits since she was the wife of a retired fireman and he's missing. The chief wasn't sure. He said he'd look into it. He'd let her know. So after he did some digging, he found out there was a life insurance policy for $110,000. And Betty Lou would be able to receive about $1,200 a month from Jimmy's pension, which would be about $3,800 today, which is a good chunk of change.
Mm-hmm. Back then, she probably could have lived off of that.
Yeah. Well, however, unless Jimmy's body was found, it would be 7 years before that could take effect. So the case went cold until about 2 years later, when the sheriff's department got a call from a confidential informant, and this was in 1985, so 2 years later, they get a confidential informant calling him. They say that Jimmy's death needs to be looked into. It was the result of foul play. So the investigators are like, you know what? Let's just go talk to Betty Lou's son. Let's see what he says. Robbie, so her favorite child. At first, he wasn't really giving many details. Eventually, he would confess that his mother had confided in him that she was planning on killing Jimmy. She told him that he couldn't be in the house when she did it, so he did as he's told. He left for a few hours, and when he returned home, he found Jimmy dead on the floor with two bullet holes. Robbie then helped his mother move his body, wrapped it in a sleeping bag, and dropped it in the wishing well that she had Jenny build for her right before his disappearance. So he literally buried or dug his own grave.
Wow.
That's cruel. Once they dropped him in the well, Betty Lou planted flowers to help conceal any evidence. Robbie was only 19 at the time. The police then began pressing Robbie, telling him that they believed he was the one that had killed Jimmy and were going to charge him with murder, because when they would go to Betty Lou with what he said, Betty Lou was actually basically telling them, it was my kid did it. They had a bad relationship and he came home, they got in a fight and he shot him and it was all the kid. So the investigators go back to Robbie and say, your mom's saying it was you, dude. But that is when Robbie started to tell them everything.
Mm-hmm.
So what actually happened is Betty Lou had placed all the items in the boat, removed the propeller from the boat, and then had Robbie launch it into the middle of the lake so that it would just kind of float away. They then went home and acted like nothing had happened. So everything that he had said really happened. And then he also brought up the part where he's like, yeah, mom did all this and sent his boat out on the lake. So while they were digging, they also found out that the life insurance policy that she took out, she had actually taken out a few life insurance policies before murdering Jimmy. During the search for Jimmy's body on the property, they happened to find another body under a storage shed. Remember husband number 4?
Mm-hmm.
He was under the storage shed.
Wow.
On that night of Doyle's murder, Betty Lou called her daughter, Shirley, and stated that she needed help with something. And Shirley asked if it had anything to do with the previous conversation they had about Betty Lou wanting to kill Doyle. Betty Lou just said, yep. So Shirley drove out to her mother's house. Betty Lou had went into the bedroom after Doyle had fallen asleep, covered the barrel of the gun with a pillow to muffle the sound, and pulled the trigger. But the gun didn't go off.
Hmm.
So now she's panicking. She's afraid he's going to wake up. So she just kind of quickly gathered herself, pulled the trigger again, and shot Doyle in the head, and then twice more in his body.
Hmm.
Shirley and Betty Lou then buried him in a hole that they had dug previously that Betty Lou had told everybody was for a fire pit. So I wonder if she made Doyle dig the hole for the fire pit, too.
Probably so.
Betty Lou then built a patio over it the following days. The gun used in the murder was in both murders was found in the house. It was also discovered the life insurance that she had taken out on them, Jimmy had no knowledge of. They actually determined that Betty Lou had forged his signature on them and had them sent to her daughter's address so that Jimmy wouldn't find out. Well, she had taken some of the paperwork home, and Jimmy found it on the counter and was like, what is this? So his niece worked at, it was like J.C. Penney something, went to her and was like, hey, what is this? And she said, it looks like somebody took out a life insurance policy. He said, we'll cancel it. So one of the ones that she had done, he was able to cancel before he died, so she wasn't able to get it. So after Jimmy died, 2 years later, she went to sell his boat that he had. Well, she still didn't have a death certificate, so she forged his signature on a bill of sale. And that signature matched the same signature as the life insurance policies that she took out.
Don't be stupid.
It is believed that the confidential informant was actually Betty Lou's new boyfriend at the time. Supposedly, she had gotten drunk one night and was bragging all about the murders to him. She was never convicted for Doyle's murder, but was sentenced to lethal injection for Jimmy's. On February 24th, 2000, Betty Lou denied her last meal and was served just the standard prison meal for that day. She was then put to death by lethal injection for Jimmy's murder. A cold ending for a woman whose life started with suffering and ended in bloodshed. So was she a victim of her own past or a cold-hearted killer?
It's a tough question.
I That's a rough life.
Yeah, it is.
Obviously, it doesn't excuse what she did, but it was just like one blow to her after another. You can see why, how it led up to it.
Kind of built her character.
It kind of leaves the nurture versus nature.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have other people that have hard lives and they don't kill anybody.
But not everybody reacts in the same way either.
That's true.
I mean,
look at our kids, for example. You got Addie and May and Jackson, all three of them, and they all react so differently to different circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Differently to the same circumstance.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
I mean,
yeah. Kids are crazy. I'll get something.
Maybe.
So that's the story of Betty Lou Beats, the Black Widow of Henderson County.
It's an interesting story.
I had never heard of that before. Me either. So thank you, Tessa. I had never heard of it.
Thank you for letting me come on your show.
Yeah. Maybe you'll get more comfortable next time.
Maybe so.
Talk a little more. And this is the first time we have video. So not only did I make him record for the first time with me, I also dropped it on him at the last minute that he's going to have a camera in his face.
I may have had a little bit of play in that part.
It's not too bad. So hopefully Tori will be back next week. We'll bring you on a couple more times. We've got a trip that's coming up, and we're going to go to Alabama, and I think we're going to go on a ghost tour. I think it'll be fun.
Maybe we'll have some interesting stories to talk about.
Yeah, so I'll take video and pictures and tell you guys how that went. You've always been kind of interested in the spooky. We'll have to bring you on and do like personal stories and stuff, like a Jeremiah's house and stuff.
Yeah.
I like your shirt. Did you pick that on purpose?
I did.
It's Bigfoot, because you can't tell. And an alien.
Being chased by a spaceship.
Jackson used to have that one, but I don't know what he did with it. Who knows? All right. Well, I guess that's a wrap. So I appreciate you guys coming, and we will be back next week with another story. Maybe it was Josh, maybe it was Tori, maybe both.
So you have to be determined.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.